This is Car Expert.
Getting to go flat out around Sandown with the R35 before it finally disappears is pretty cool.
While hybrids are a bridging technology, for the now, I think they're actually a fantastic solution, and I do wish more brands were doing what Toyota did.
It actually remembers where the lift occurred GPS-wise, and as soon as you come to your driveway each night, it'll automatically lift.
Welcome to a brand new year. If you haven't heard my voice before, my name's Mandy Turner and I'm joined by Mike Costello. Hello, Moco.
Great to see you again, Mandy. Unfortunately, yeah. My voice is not as pleasant to listen to as yours for the sake of the listeners, but nevertheless, here I am.
You're the guy who knows cars. That's why we've got you on in the first place. Jack Quick, hello.
Hello, Mandy. How are you?
Very good. Nice to be back for a new year. What car did you have over the break, by the way?
So I had a first kind of long-term car over the little Christmas break that we had. I had a base model Kia Sportage S automatic with the 2-litre naturally aspirated engine, and I loved it.
Where did you go?
So I went home. I left Melbourne, which was very nice to do in the first place. I went to my family's house out halfway to Adelaide in between Horsham and Mildura in a town called Brim. So I went there for Christmas, which is about 400 k's away. And then I went up to above Shepparton to a place called Yalupna along the Murray River for camping. The car got quite dirty and dusty, but it was a really nice tourer for those long trips, and it was a good camping companion.
Lovely. What did the fam think of it? Did you take it for a ride?
Yeah, no, they thought it was very nice. It had good air conditioning. That was the first thing they noticed. It was very hot and had loads of space. Those were the two main things that they had to say about the car.
Fantastic. Mocha, we probably won't talk about your car. You had a D-Max over the break, but you're in a much more exciting car, Hyundai Kona N.
Yeah, so I'm doing a bunch of landscaping at my house at the moment that I'm renovating, and I thought, you know, I'm going to grab the D-Max, but it's not that interesting to talk about. But, yes, I did pick up the keys yesterday to the Hyundai Kona N, and I don't know if it's the most ridiculous, stupid car that's ever been made in a good way or in a bad way, but I do know that it's the most ridiculous, stupid car that's ever been made because I've never driven a Hyundai Kona and gone, you know what this car needs? It needs to have like a 200-kilowatt turbo engine, and it needs to have a DCT, and it needs to drive like an i30N. Like, it needs to ride stiffly and be Nürburgring-tuned. But nevertheless, that's what this car is, and I think I'm leaning towards wanting to congratulate Hyundai for being bold enough to make a car like this, you know, and I'm trying to be positive about it in a sort of tongue-in-cheek way because I actually love just how off the wall it is and what a sort of interesting alternative it is to a conventional hot hatch. So I'm going to take that out to maybe the Reefton Spur or somewhere this weekend and give it a proper crack and see what we can do. I know Marich has had the keys to it as well, so we'll, you know, bash our heads together and come up with a good conclusion. But, yeah, really interesting car.
Well, speaking of interesting cars, Jack, we've got the Tokyo Auto Salon coming up this year. No doubt we're going to expect some pretty crazy concepts.
Yeah, no doubt, I reckon. I've been doing a lot of writing about this upcoming 2022 Tokyo Auto Salon for the last week or so since returning back to work. And from Daihatsu, there's going to be two K-car concepts using the A-Tree K-car, very small K-car with two, like a camper one. And then there's going to be a Honda Civic Type R prototype revealed. And then there's going to be from Mitsubishi, there's the reinvention of Rally Art. So it's back again. So we've already seen it. It's called the Vision Rally Art concept. Although it sounds like it's going to be a Lancer and editor, it's an Outlander FEV. Although they don't mention that at all. It's going to be cool to see in the metal, I reckon. It looks very dark and menacing, and
I could not get over the press release for that. I was reading it as well, Jack, and Mitsubishi, you know, painstakingly refused to say the word Outlander. They kept talking about it's the return of Rally Art, it's the new Rally Art, it's the future of Rally Art, here's the car. And I wanted to just say, it's clearly an Outlander. Like, why don't you say Outlander? But to Mitsubishi's credit, it does have more motor power from its plug-in hybrid system, and Mitsubishi's long promised that it would try to sex up the plug-in hybrid tech. So, you know, this could actually be something semi-interesting on the performance front from Mitsubishi, and, you know, God knows we haven't seen that for a while now. So very, very welcome.
From Mitsubishi as well, they're kind of bringing back the iMiEV, but not as we know it. It's going to be an electric K-car concept that is planning to come to fruition in a production version. I think it's this year. And then from Nissan as well, we're going to see a few different things. We're going to obviously see the Z, I should pronounce it as. And there's also going to be a GT500 racer version. So, and then there's also going to be caravan-based. So the caravan is kind of like a Japanese market-only version of like the, it looks like a Hiace more or less, but there's going to be a concept car called the Mountain Base, which is going to be like their adventure-style vehicle. And then from Subaru, we're going to see a concept car called the STI-ERA. So I'm guessing the E kind of hints towards some sort of electrified vehicle of sorts. Most likely going to be WRX-based. I don't actually know that for certain. So far, only teaser images have been shown. Toyota, there's going to be a GR GT3 concept, which is in a similar sense to that as GT500. And then most interestingly from Toyota, there's going to be a tuned version of the GR Yaris with some, which has been teased with a really cool spoiler and a few different garnishes to make it look a little bit sportier. Today, I wrote on a story on a Lexus LX 600 modified version. So it's based on the off-road version of the LX 600, which is the Toyota 300 series Land Cruiser, and it's got these kind of, I want to say in a nice way, ricey accessories. So it's very cliche and a little bit, I don't know how to describe it, but it just, it's supposed to look off-roady, and there's going to be some more that we don't already know. So looking forward to it.
Yes, bring on those K cars, I say. Well, you can keep your eye on the site for all the coverage of the Tokyo Auto Salon. News time, it is. Jack, finally, another car brand has decided to move to 5 years unlimited kilometre warranty.
Yes, that is the case. It should be really the standard 5 years, if not more. But Audi has announced that it is going to a 5-year unlimited kilometre warranty as of just a couple of days ago, which is well overdue, I would think, at least anyway. So Audi has ditched its previous 3-year warranty in favour for this 5-year warranty, which I've already said is very good. And it aligns itself with the Volkswagen and Skoda sibling companies in the Volkswagen group. And it also brings it in line with other luxury brands such as Mercedes-Benz, Lexus, Genesis, Volvo, and Jaguar Land Rover. So they all have 5-year warranty. All individually. And now the only two luxury brands that are stuck with 3-year warranty for now are BMW and Alfa Romeo. From what we've reported so far this week, it does seem like they're going to stick with these for now, or they're evaluating to see what's going to happen. But it's still regardless, and it's 3 years.
I need to move with the times, I think.
I won't name names here, but I have spoken to people working for at least one of those companies who've said to me that their customers aren't particularly concerned about a longer warranty, which is the silliest thing I've ever heard, because who the hell would say no to a longer warranty? The fact of the matter is, for people out there listening, because the vast majority of car brands are 5 years, there's a very good chance that Australian consumer law and the ACCC's fair use period would be that 5-year period. I would say you would have a very strong case were your car that you bought now to, you know, theoretically conk out in 4 years with a 3-year warranty. You could probably consider talking to the ACCC about, you know, whether 3 years is enough, frankly. And I think you're seeing as more and more brands adopt 5 years as sort of the norm now, the outliers are going to start to look sillier and sillier, and it's going to become more of an issue. And we're going to make sure we keep the sort of heat on them to bring their warranties into line.
So one thing I think that's going to happen with this change to 5 years, I don't know whether it's going to actually happen, but I think pretty strongly it's obviously going to mean more sales for Audi. So going to see more, I think we might see it obviously with VFACTS updates later on in a few months' time, but probably going to see more sales of all the models and more confidence in buying an Audi, because if you just have those 3 years, it's what, as Mike said, like what happens if you go into that fourth year and something blows up or blah, 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 blah. And with a luxury brand, that means big dollars. So with that extra 2 years, it just gives you that peace of mind and that added security to just know. Although I think I'd like more than 5 years, like kind of go in the route of maybe Kia with the 7 year warranty, or I don't know whether that far, but maybe the Mitsubishi with 10 years. I think that's the absolute gold standard, even though with Mitsubishi, you need to service it at their dealerships in order to get the full 10 year. I think that is the kind of level that other automakers just need to, or Australian automaker divisions need to get on their level, because otherwise they're going to get left behind. Sorry, BMW and Alfa Romeo, already getting left behind. So chop chop is what I have to say.
Absolutely. Hey, Moko, what do you think, like where do these warranties end? Like we've got 10 years with, what, a couple of manufacturers at the moment. Do you reckon that's going to stay like that, or is it going to continue to rise?
I mean, there's a cost accrued, frankly. So typically factories overseas will warranty cars for a certain period of time, but it's then on, you know, the onus is then on the local subsidiary to back its vehicles for a certain period of time beyond that if they want it. I don't think anything more than 10 years is particularly necessary, because that's, I mean, let's be honest, a lot of things can happen to a car in 10 years. And I think even five is fair for me. I think, you know, if a car starts to have some issues after 5 or 6 years, if it's got 100,000 plus Ks on it, you know, that's where it starts to become probably at least semi-acceptable. So 5 years feels about right for me. I think the key factor is, as long as the ACCC's definition of fair use is aligned with the warranty period, that's the sort of happy medium for me. So 5 years, roughly 100,000 Ks feels about right. That being said, when Kia introduced a 7-year warranty all those years ago, I mean, it directly linked that to its spike in sales because of what it did for the brand. And I think you'll see with a number of new brands coming into market, we've already seen some of the Chinese marks like GWM, Haval also follow and have a 7-year warranty. Brands will use it as a marketing tool, especially those that don't really have runs on the board, because it's inherently a way to generate trust. So you'll probably see that start to happen. But yeah, I'm happy with anything more than 5 years. Anything less than 5 years at this point is frankly underdone.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to do a 2021 VFACT wrap after the news. But I suppose we have a bit of a teaser here, Moko. Toyota hybrids broke all sorts of sales records last year.
Yeah. So I don't want to sound like a Toyota representative or shill here. I'm a huge supporter of electrification of vehicles across all their facets, particularly battery electric. And Toyota has been miles behind the times when it comes to that. But what it has done is it has popularized just hybrid cars. Now, hybrid cars, they're about $2,500 to $3,000 more than non-hybrids. They cut fuel use by sometimes as much as 50%. And when you are talking those sorts of scales, the CO2 reductions are actually really extensive. So Toyota sold an all-time record 65,491 hybrids last year. Jeez. So when you extrapolate that out at scale, you start to see, you know, yes, they're not as good at an individual basis at mitigating CO2 emissions as an EV or a plug-in hybrid, but at, you know, those massive numbers, Toyota's actually doing more than most when it comes to reducing its emissions. That all-time record equated to about 29%, 29.3% to be precise, of its overall sales last year. But if you take out commercial vehicles, because Toyota has no commercial hybrid vehicles as yet, it was actually more like 45%. So almost half of the passenger cars and SUVs sold by the number one brand in the market were hybrid cars last year. When the first Prius launched 20 years ago, hybrids were a joke. They were a novelty. They were never going to go anywhere. I think a lot of manufacturers got ahead of themselves and said, you know, it's got to go from petrol to electric, and they haven't bothered with the in-between bit. And I think Toyota is really capitalizing, because it's the only brand that really makes decent hybrids that are sold in this country. From that subset of 65,000 hybrids sold last year, 25,850 of them were RAV4s. That's despite an average wait list of 12 months. And that average wait list is direct from the mouth of the CEO of Toyota Australia. So that's a pretty accurate figure, which means 72% of all RAV4s sold last year were the hybrid model. Corolla was next, and 51% of Corollas were hybrids, 84% of Camrys, 65% of Yaris Crosses, and 53% of Klugers. So all of those five huge volume models are now majority hybrid. And when you compare that to even 2 or 3 years ago, that is a staggering increase. As Toyota starts to roll out the promised hybrid commercial vehicles, say hybrid Hiluxes, those CO2reductions are going to become even more significant, and that technology is going to become even more accepted because an entirely new audience will be opened up to it. So while hybrids are a bridging technology, for the now, I think they're actually a fantastic solution, and I do wish more brands were doing what Toyota did, because the market is clearly speaking. If you can say $3,000 more for a car that cuts your fuel use by 50%, people are willing to put their money down, and if they could get decent supply, they would have sold even more of. So bloody impressive.
I suppose it also helps that a lot of people understand the hybrid technology as opposed to EVs or plug-in hybrids too.
Yeah, especially plug-in hybrids. I think EVs are pretty easy to get your head around. You know, it's a battery and a motor. And hybrid, you know, it's mostly a petrol car and there's a little motor that helps you out from time to time. Plug-in hybrids are super confusing because there's about 100 different manifestations and they operate very differently depending on how you're using them. And hybrids are so simple. It's that set and forget thing. Now, I don't like the fact that Toyota calls them self-charging hybrids. I think that's a bit misleading because that implies something that they're not. But overall, it's pretty easy tech to get your head around, pretty idiot-proof. You just put your fuel pump in like anything else and it does the rest. And clearly it's resonating.
Yeah. Jack.
Hello.
Tesla have added a chill and assertive mode to full self-driving. I should do that in air quotes, full self-driving. What do these modes do?
Yeah, I was just about to say, if you didn't say it, I was going to say air quotes for full self-driving. It's full self-driving, but it's not. So Tesla has gone ahead and added modes to its full self-driving software that supposedly drives the car without the driver needing, but it needs the hands on the wheel. So it's not that. So it said it's called chill and assertive, and they kind of do what the words obviously mean. So there's a chill mode for an everyday, relaxed, very distant system that kind of keeps a large distance between the car ahead. It doesn't do very many lane changes. Very, very relaxing driving experience, whereas assertive, that's where it starts to get a little bit more manic is how I would describe it. So with this assertive mode, it is obviously more assertive and more crazy and just a heightened version of the regular full self-driving system. So it changes lanes more frequently. It keeps a closer gap between the car ahead. It will hog the outward lane, the passing lane, if needed. And it can also roll through stop signs. So that's obviously more targeted towards the US market because that's illegal in Australia. But it's kind of creating like a gray area where like when is this like too dangerous, like keeping like being so close to a car ahead and you're not really driving the car, if something goes wrong, blah blah blah. I know I sound like kind of like an old man when I'm saying this, but like it's with this assertive mode, is this kind of like a step too far, and like what will this mean for like I don't really know what that means. If Tesla will be liable, but like all these different kind of things, it just sounds a little bit too dangerous. So this is starting to be rolled out in all of the cars that do have paid for the full self-driving package. And most recently, there's been a beta testing in certain US owners that had to have scored a certain score, and they have access to this beta technology before it gets rolled out to the public. But although it is a level 2 plus system, which is kind of to put in another way, you need to have your hands on the wheel. It's not a hands-off system, so it's not full self-driving. But would you trust full self-driving in its most assertive setting?
Well, my biggest concern with this, Jack, is, and I've said this for a long time, is that Tesla beta tests on the public and most OEMs beta test on proving grounds. Tesla's motivation is fantastic in the grand scheme, in that, you know, self-driving vehicles will be a good thing because most people don't like driving, and that leaves the road to enthusiasts like us to enjoy actually steering vehicles. But the problem is this intermediary period, and it opens up a massive can of worms around who is liable. Is it the insurance company? Is it the driver? Is it the car maker? Is it, you know, the government that makes the roads? There are so many other issues around self-driving. It's not just about the technology. It's not just about the actual vehicle itself. It's about the entire ecosystem in which they exist. And Tesla will always be on the edge. And its wording around full self-driving is quite misleading as far as I'm concerned, because it's not full self-driving. We've seen accidents already happen in the United States from drivers who have been overconfident in the system. And so Tesla is playing with fire here. But, hey, that's the way Elon Musk rolls. He ain't going to change. So, you know, Elon's going to Elon.
Mm. He wants to hold to the passing lane. That's what.
Yeah.
Oh, I feel like that assertive mode is everything that a lot of people hate on the roads. Like,
yes.
Yeah.
100%.
Oh, dear. Asking for trouble. Oh, look, Marco, we're back to Toyota. The Land Cruiser 300 series has got a 5-star ANCAP safety rating. Fantastic.
Yeah, so obviously 300 series Land Cruiser, one of the most hyped cars for a long time. As you would expect, a 5-star crash rating these days is hardly news, right? I mean, it's more news if a car doesn't get 5 stars. But the Land Cruiser is the first car to get the 2022 date stamp. It's also the first Land Cruiser, obviously, to test this well against the full suite of the latest ANCAP tests. And ANCAP now obviously puts a lot of emphasis on driver assist tech as well. So it got 88% for child occupant protection, 89% for adult occupant protection, 77% for its driver aids. And ANCAP is really good now at testing all of those driver aids, like lane assist and autonomous braking and things like that. And it also got 81% for vulnerable road user protection, which is the second best score to date under the latest test protocols. And when you consider the Land Cruiser has the aerodynamics of a shed and it weighs 2.5 tons and it's got this enormous bluff nose on it, the fact that it actually is quite good at protecting vulnerable road users on impact is really impressive. A lot of that comes down to how effective its autonomous emergency braking system is at detecting pedestrians and cycles, both at night and in the daytime. So in all of the tests that ANCAP did, it was very good at recognizing vulnerable road users and mitigating collisions with them. So very impressive from Toyota to take a car that's obviously designed for being off-road and designed for towing, but making sure that they make it as safe as they possibly can. So very reassuring to the majority of buyers, no doubt.
Another crazy year has passed us, so we thought it would be a good idea to look back on the year that was for 2021 new vehicle sales in Australia. Moko, was last year an improvement all up over 2020?
Twas, but it would bloody well want to be, wouldn't it? Considering 2020 was a bit of an outlier year. The reality is 2021 was just as COVID affected as 2020 was, and the supply situation around semiconductors and shipping, and we all know the headwinds. Every news story talks about them. I don't need to elaborate on them here. It all got worse in 2021, but dealers got way better at selling cars online, you know, drop and deliver, click and collect, all that sort of stuff. So car brands, you know, figured it out. Sales climbed 14.5% despite all those headwinds to 1,049,831 new vehicles, which is not exactly getting us back to the halcyon days of about a decade ago, but it's certainly better than it was in 2020. And it does get us over that psychological million unit mark, which, you know, is always established as kind of the baseline. The top line stuff, Toyota Hilux, top-selling vehicle for, I think it was the sixth year in succession, beat the Ford Ranger. Toyota was number one, as always. Market share north of 20%, dominated number one in 8 vehicle segments, far and away the leader. Mazda was second, the only other brand that topped 100,000 sales. Hyundai in third, just edged out Ford by the skin of its teeth. MG, the Chinese budget brand, was ninth. So this is the first time a Chinese manufacturer has finished the year in the top 10. And it's safe to say that brand China is mainstream now, because Great Wall was 14th overall. So two Chinese brands inside the top 14. Private sales were well up, which means sales to just normal people. Business fleet sales were quite sluggish, so not a whole lot better than 2020. So business confidence is obviously not where it was. rental cars are flying off the shelves and private cars are also growing at a rate of knots. And if supply was better, they'd be even higher. Electric vehicles are up 200% and plug-in hybrids are up about 100%. So alternate fuel cars, and we talked about the hybrid boom earlier before. So the proportion of, you know, lower emission vehicles was also at an all-time record. Looking at the brands, I spoke on the top four before, Toyota, Mazda, Hyundai, Ford. Fifth place was Kia, an absolute whisker ahead of Mitsubishi in sixth, Nissan in seventh, a fair way back, Volkswagen eighth, a victim of supply if ever there was one, MG ninth, and rounding out the top 10 was Subaru with just over 37,000 sales. Knocking on the door of the top 10, Isuzu Ute. For a brand with only two cars to sell, pretty extraordinary that it finished 11th, edged out Mercedes-Benz, BMW, Great Wall Motor, and in 15th place, Honda, down 40% to 17,500 sales. Do you remember when Honda sold 60,000 sales and was easily a top 10 player? Yeah, those days are gone, unfortunately. So not a whole lot of surprises as far as the brand list is concerned. If we look to the top-selling models, Hilux number one, 52,000 sales. Ranger, just over 50,000, but in the 4x4 market where all the actual profit lies, the Ranger was number one. So I don't think Ford would mind losing the sales race to Toyota because they made a ton more money. RAV4 was third overall, vast majority being the hybrid. Corolla number four. So Toyota made the top selling commercial vehicle, SUV and passenger car, just ahead of the Hyundai i30 in fifth. And the top list of, you know, the top 20 cars, very, very few surprises. Essentially the same top 20 that we see every month. Okay, so the category breakdowns, SUVs, 531,700 sales. So that's more than half of all the vehicles sold were SUVs, which is the highest proportion of SUVs that we've ever seen. Probably not overly surprising. Light commercials, 24.1% of the market, so just over 250,000 sales. Once again, an all-time high. And passenger cars, and VFAX considers passenger cars to be hatchbacks, sedans, wagons, coupes, convertibles, and people carriers. So basically anything that's not an SUV or a ute or a van. All-time low, 21.1% market share, 221,000 sales. So that mix of SUVs dominating is well and truly what we're seeing. If we go a bit more granular, we can see that the top segments by market share were 4x4 utes, specifically with 18.1%, medium-sized SUVs. That's everything from the Toyota RAV4 at the mainstream end through to the Mercedes GLC at the premium end, 17.2% share. Small SUVs just behind, then large SUVs, then small cars on 10.4%. So small cars, the only passenger segment in the top five. So we've been seeing the trend of utes, vans and SUVs dominating and passenger cars plummeting for a while, and 2021 really was just a continuation of that.
Yeah, okay. Maybe we should look ahead for this year. I'm keen to pick your brain about this, Moko. The top brand to look out for this year and any predictions for a sales percentage at the end of the year?
There's a few brands to look out for this year, actually. I think Great Wall and GWM Haval, to be, you know, more respectful to the branding that they use, will continue to grow because the H6 hybrid SUV is coming. The GWM pickup will have another full year with a bit more reputation behind it. The Jolyon hybrid's coming. So I think you'll see GWM really giving MG a run for its money in the sort of bottom end of the market. Nissan, which has sort of been flagging for a while now, is going to get an absolute avalanche of new product, new Qashqai, new X-Trail, new Pathfinder, new Z. I think you'll see a lot of buzz around Nissan, and it may not be reflected in a sort of sales spike in the first quarter of the year, but I think overall Nissan will have a much better year than it did this year and indeed for the last few. And ultimately, electric cars and plug-in hybrids will continue their merry march. So we're seeing with most states now offering some sort of incentive to buy an electric car, be it a direct rebate, be it funding infrastructure, be it tax cuts. Those things are making EVs more appetizing. They're also drawing more choice into the market. So there's an absolute, you know, cavalcade of new electric cars coming. Plug-in hybrids ditto. There are a ton of, you know, really highly anticipated plug-in hybrids to come this year too. So the alternate fuel stuff, I expect you might even see, you know, that market share doubling to what it was this year, I think, are the major ones. And then finally, there's no reason not to expect passenger cars to continue to plummet and SUVs and commercials to continue to grow. I think the audience has definitely spoken where that's concerned. The big elephant in the room is going to be supply. So semiconductor suppliers are still, you know, obviously hurting. The supply chain is reeling at the moment. You know, we can't even buy food in Woolies and Panadol at the chemist, let alone cars. So I think you'll find that supply will be the big issue. The demand is there, but the supply obviously isn't, and it's not going to be for most of this year for most manufacturers. So you'll continue to see long waiting lists for a lot of the market's most in-demand cars. That will be the major impediment to this year's growth. But I think, you know, a lot of those kinks will start to iron themselves out as the year progresses. At least that's what it looks like at the present. So it's going to be a similar year to what we saw in 2021, but all of the trends that we saw will probably sort of pick up steam, would be my prediction.
Just wondering if there was anything interesting or anything you weren't expecting to see from the 2021 VFAX, or if it was just exactly what you thought would happen.
Well, I don't profess to have a crystal ball, and there were obviously a few things that I did get a few of my predictions right. I did predict MG would hit the top 10, so I was quite happy to sort of predict that because a few people laughed at me at the time. I think one of the ones I think you'll see this year is there's a very good chance that Ranger will actually take the top selling spot from Hilux if Ford can get supply. Because as we know, the new generation Ford Ranger comes this year and it looks brilliant and it has all of the right attributes to, you know, put the nail in the coffin of some of its competitors, as it were, until they get their, you know, sort their stuff out. So I think if Ford can get adequate supply of new Ranger, you might see a Ford on top of the sales charts again, which would be super interesting. The other thing, Jack, that I thought was interesting this year were perhaps some of the smaller scale manufacturers that actually grew when perhaps I didn't expect them to. So Jeep was up 35%, Genesis was up 220%, Skoda up 39%. So those are some sort of smaller volume brands. Volvo up 17% ahead of the market average. So some of those sort of tier two brands, I think you'll see continue to build on that. I was really surprised this year at Honda's sort of fall. Honda did say that its sales would decline. It did say when it changed its business model in July to an agency model focused on higher spec vehicles that it was going to decline in the sales race, but I didn't expect it to decline as much as it did. And I worry about Honda. I really do. I think this year it's not looking good for it again. The price of the Civic is ridiculous, and I think you'll see Honda continue to struggle a bit this year and perhaps not get the kind of numbers that it would like to. It will continue to talk positively about it externally, but I'm sure internally it would like to be selling more cars than it is.
Yeah. All right, that 2021 VFACT wrap is at the site if you would like to read a little bit more in depth about that. It must be sports car week this week because we jump out of a 911 and into a Nissan GTR, but this car is bittersweet for us Aussies, as it will no longer be sold here from this year. Scott Colley, you got a chance to give it a fitting farewell by ripping laps around at Sandown Raceway. Hello.
Hello, Mandy. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too. I think you did this last year, didn't you?
I did, yeah. So the way that embargoes are all set up means that this was actually done quite early in December, but because everyone goes off on break and we had to video the car and all sorts of things, the story only went live just after we came back from the break on December 6th. I realise talking about the break like that makes me sound like I'm at school and the term has started again, but you sort of know how it works over Christmas. So,
absolutely. Yeah. All right, so I have to ask you the most obvious question. How much fun did you have?
I had so much fun. I've been lucky enough to drive an R32 GTR before on the road. And I've also had a bit of an experience in an R34, but not much experience. But this is one of those cars that growing up, because it's been around for so long, it was first revealed, I think, in 2007. So I was in year seven at the time. But I've grown up watching this car be developed and reading about it from when I was a kid. And it's just one of those ones that every car enthusiast, I think, wants to experience because it's such an icon. So, yeah, getting to go flat out around Sandown with the R35 before it finally disappears was pretty cool.
Yeah. Do you think it'll be missed in Australia?
Of course it will. Yeah, I mean, it's not a big seller. Nissan has sold fewer than 100 a year since it was globally launched in 2007. It only came to Australia a bit after that, but it's not a big volume car. So it's not as if millions of buyers are crying, but it's one of those really cool cars that, for one, is a little bit different and has a really interesting take on how to go fast. But it's also just its diversity. And as we look at, you know, the car sales charts, people are buying utes and SUVs. Passenger cars are dying. Sports car sales are reasonably slow. So losing another interesting car from the roads and a car that makes kids turn and people get excited or, you know, relate to their childhood is always a shame.
Mm. Just rewind a little bit. You said something about it has an interesting take on how to go fast. What did you mean by that?
Well, the GTR, and this is probably going to bring back some Top Gear memories for people, but it's got some incredible engineering in it. So it's powered by a twin turbo V6 engine, and there's all sorts of incredible facts about how it's built. They're built by, you know, by hand in a specific part of a specific plant in Japan. It's got a titanium exhaust. It's got, like, I remember Top Gear making a big deal of the nitrogen in the tires because normal air or normal oxygen is too volatile. But right down to the fact that the engine is sort of front mid-mounted, but the dual clutch transmission and the limited slip diff are out behind the rear seat. And then there's also a center differential to actually manage all-wheel drive. So if it's sending power to the front, the power goes from the engine at the front to the gearbox at the back to a differential one on the rear axle and then back through to the front of the car. And it all does it in the blink of an eye. It's incredibly fast. And it's all very mechanical. Although there's computers controlling it, it's all happening through clunking drive shafts and bits and pieces. So we're very used in 2021 or 2022 now, I suppose it is, to cars with really fancy all-wheel drive systems that are able to, you know, unlock the rear diff or completely decouple the front for drift mode and that sort of thing. The GTR's been doing something like that since 2007, but it's not doing it with computers and, you know, like fancy clutch packs and that sort of thing. It's doing it in a more mechanical way, which is really unique. Mm. It's just a really, really interesting car, and that does come through in the way you drive it.
Well, I suppose we should get to your track time now. I suppose you could call a GTR a bit of a chunky sort of car. It's quite a big thing. Do you think it was better at cornering or straight lines or both?
So, yeah, it is a chunky beast of a thing. And in person, you really notice that. It manages to be, like, quite compact and quite low, but it's still got that really blocky, boxy sort of Japanese look to it. It's so fast in a straight line. I mean, we've been talking for years about how the GTR gets off the line, but this car is now 15 years old, essentially.
Wow.
But the engine has been constantly refined, now has 419 kilowatts and 632 newton meters. It pulls so hard. It's doing 240 k's an hour down the back straight at Sandown, and it just feels like it'll keep going if I wasn't soft and if I didn't need to go around the corner. But I think the interesting thing about the way it goes around the corner is, yes, it is a big car, and yes, it is reasonably heavy. And you do notice that a little bit. I mean, it does move around a little bit. It doesn't feel completely lightning dialed in like some of the other really fast stuff I've driven, but it does change direction really well, and it also feels far livelier than I expected. We had the traction control turned on the whole time, which, given these cars are worth about 250 grand new and they're listed for about $1 million on the classifieds, I think is pretty sensible. But under brakes, you can feel the back get a little bit light and feel like the car wants to rotate, and it feels quite like active and agile in that sense. And then once you get into the corner, if you put your foot down a bit too early, the car goes, this guy doesn't know what he's doing, and sends power to the front axle and you get a bit of understeer. Whereas if you're a bit more patient, you get the car rotated and then you put your foot down at the right time with the right amount of steering lock on, you can actually feel the power go to the back and the car feel very like rear biased or rear driven. So yes, it's big and heavy, and yes, there's a lot going on, but it's really clever, and it's clever in a way that you can actually, it feels like you could, with a lot more time, get to know very well and get to manipulate to get the most out of it. We had about 20 minutes behind the wheel, and obviously that's, you know, enough time to get a feel for the car, but not enough time to really come to master what it's doing in any sense. So I came away going, oh, I've learned a lot about what's happening and I'm really impressed by what it'll do, but I want to spend hours or a day with it around the track to really get to know it.
I suppose it's sort of hard to explain this, but what did it sound like at 240 clicks?
So I honestly couldn't tell you because I was concentrating so hard. On the podcast, I know Crawf likes to come on and say, oh, it's in, you know, it does this and that at high speed and I'm an incredible driver. And we like to make jokes about that as well because obviously it's a motoring journo thing to talk yourself up. I have to admit that I was concentrating really hard. I had a helmet on. My head was on the roof of the car because I'm quite tall. And I can tell you that it sounds like metallic and sort of angry. I wouldn't say it's particularly tuneful noise. It's not like a Porsche 6 when you're really up it. It is still like an industrial effective V6, but I can't give you specific tasting notes on the noise, unfortunately, at that speed because I was thinking very hard about where to brake and not putting the car in the wall.
So I suppose with that concentration that you were using, how did you find the cabin and all the buttons and all those sort of things to use?
I think that's what ages the GTR most. You look at the car and it still looks a little bit old compared to some of the new sports cars out there. It's bigger and it doesn't have the fancy, you know, slim LED lighting and that sort of thing. But when you get in the car, you really do notice its age. It's got quite a simple dashboard with a big rev counter and a little digital monochrome speedo in the bottom corner. All the graphics in the infotainment system, and this was a huge deal at launch, were designed by the people from Gran Turismo. And they still look really cool, but in 2007, that was incredible. In 2022, the Hyundai i20N that I drove over Christmas has a similar thing. So a lot of what made the car really exciting or interesting or unique at launch when it comes to the technology has now been matched or bettered by rivals. I will say, though, that the T-Spec, which is the last car coming to Australia, has a really cool green interior finish. It's got green leather and Alcantara seats with a beautiful, intricate stitching detail in the headlining. And it sounds kind of horrible. It's a weird sort of detail that the car's green inside, but combined with the Millennium Jade or the Midnight Purple exterior, it's actually quite an interesting sort of subtle color, and I think it really makes the car stand out. You do notice in a few other spots that it's, for one, a Nissan and two, a little bit old. So I had a quick fiddle with the infotainment standing still. I wasn't trying to put addresses in at 240 k's an hour. And it definitely isn't up to scratch compared to what you get in a Porsche 911 or a Mercedes AMG GT or something like that. But it is worth remembering that, for one, this car is a Nissan, and two, the fastest one that money can buy in Australia, the Nismo SV, which is incredibly limited and is part of that last run, is $393,000. When it was on sale in full production, the GTR Premium was $193,800, which is cheaper than the cheapest Porsche 911. So even though it has got more expensive over its life, I think the car can justify being a bit old and not being quite as high-tech on the driver infotainment front because, for one, the driving experience is so cool and the car is so cool. It's not the point. You're not buying it for Apple CarPlay. But also it still does undercut a lot of the really, really fast stuff that GT has also always competed with. And like in my review, I've written that it's, you know, about $100,000 cheaper than BMW M8 competition, the T-Spec. And the top of the range GTR Premium, depending on, you know, what you look at, is similar money to like a C63 AMG convertible. And it's far more capable and far more unique than both those cars.
Yeah, that'll get the heads turning way more than those others. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
That track review is at Car Expert now if you would like to go and take a look. Thank you, Scott Colley.
Thanks, Mandy.
Hello, Tony Crawford.
Mandy, how are you? And good to see you in the 2022.
Well, it's hard to think that last year, which was actually last month, we spoke to you about your time with the Porsche 911 GT3 on the track. But since we last spoke, you've had the chance to live with this car day to day off the track. I'm assuming a GT3 would be challenging as a daily driver as it's basically a track machine. How did you find living with it?
You know what? I couldn't wait to get in this car because, as you know, I mean, if you're an avid track day fan, you're probably not going to be there more than three or four times a year, right? So you have to be able to live with it on a daily basis. And here's the thing: I was just as in love with it on track as when I brought it home and parked it in the driveway in that shark blue. I'm in love with that color. I don't think there's ever been a better color for a 911 bar the tangerine that I also love.
Or the crayon.
The tangerine. No, the crayon. Crayon's I've got nice. No, it's just what? A modern color. You know, Porsches should be out there, particularly the GT cars. And I think that shark blue with the shark blue wheel rims and the roundels of the lights, you know, that blue as well, and the lap sash seat belts, it just works on that car. And look, can you live with it as a daily? Yeah, I reckon you can. If that's the only car you had to drive, then 100%. I'm not sure you can live with the $11,000 racing seats. That's like you want them on track. And when we track tested that car at Sydney Motorsport Park, none of us used the harnesses, the four or six, but I think they're 4-point harnesses. No one used them because you don't need to unless you're actually racing. But, you know, to get, you know, Luke Yulden did a 137 around Eastern Creek, which is incredible. That's faster than V8 supercars, I think you'll find, or certainly very close to it. And he did that in the standard, not the standard, but the optional racing seats that are, I think, about 11,200. And to be honest, I don't know what the standard GT3 seats are like because I've, you know, they're all that way. All the press cars have got the optional racing seats in, which are very comfortable. It's not that they're not comfortable. They've got stack of cushioning in their Alcantara. It's just that you can't get out of the bloody things. I mean, you know what I mean? You probably got a teammate at a track event that's pulling you out, or if you're actually racing them. So, yeah, that's the big thing is getting it. You do get better at it. You get more accustomed to it. But, by God, you need to keep going to the gym and remain flexible. And you need to have strong quads to lift yourself out of there.
Did you go grocery shopping in it?
I did, 100%. I went to the gym every day in it, and I wanted to live with it. And I went to Coles down the thing. It's got a front lift system. I think it's standard on the Australian models, and you just touch a button on the front dash, one of the toggle buttons, and it raises up, I think, about 2 or 3 centimetres. I've got a video posted on my own Insta, and hopefully Car Experts Insta page will have posted it too, but it shows the lift. It's a very slight lift, but it's enough to get over, you know, problematic driveways. And the beauty of this front lift system is it actually remembers where the lift occurred GPS-wise, and as soon as you come to your driveway each night, it'll automatically lift. And so that's a really good thing. So what happens is when you do lift it manually, up comes a little window on the screen and it says, do you want to remember this location? Bang, and you hit it and you don't have to do it again. Which is fabulous, right?
Very much so.
As I kept telling people, there was a lot of interest in this car around our area, and anyone that stopped me, you couldn't believe how good the car looked and all that. It is the best-looking 911 I think I've ever seen. That's a big statement, but that wing, that swan neck wing, it works because it's quite low profile, believe it or not. I'm not sure the same can be said of the RS that's due in about a year to 18 months' time. I think that'll be over the top and very much like an RSR, 911 RSR, which is a full-blown Le Mans racer and the RSR series in Europe. And I think that'll be another level again. I can't believe that you could make a better car than this. And you know, I really enjoyed it. I stuck to the speed limit. I accelerated a couple of times out of my house once I got all four wheels off the driveway. And it's fantastic fun, but you don't buy a GT3 for outright pace. If you wanted to be outright pace, you'd probably buy a Tesla Model S Plaid. And destroy everything that you could ever see, including, you know, mega cars effectively. So this car's all about handling. And I just couldn't believe some of the corners locally that, you know, you normally have to brake for. You just keep your foot into it and you go around these corners and it just feels natural. That's the thing with a GT car and a GT3 particularly. It just feels natural. And, you know, I think there's a bit of gloating when you're behind the wheel of a GT3. No one wants to take you on, really. And there's a big smile on my face when I go past a Ferrari or whatever, because those guys are not going to take you on around corners, because this thing will do. Actually, I did have, funnily enough, a guy in a GTI Golf get up right behind me in some very tight corners going home to my place. And I just had to put the boot in and, you know, hammer into a roundabout and then hammer out of a roundabout. And he was already 100 metres behind me by the time I did that. But I had to put him in his place, guys. He can't think in a Golf GI he's going to keep up with the GT3. I can't let him think that.
You know? Hey, Croft,
See you keep doing that sort of stuff until you're 100 years old, Croft.
Yes, absolutely. Probably, mate.
Which is actually only a few weeks away, right?
Oh, that's not quite true.
Did you take the wife for a spin, and did you manage to persuade her that you want one?
Here's the thing, Mandy. We went to dinner over the eastern suburb with friends who just bought a little unit there, and over at Potts Point, and we took the GT3.
Nice.
And I think that's like the second or third time she's been in a 911, even though, you know, I had one for so long. She'd never gone in it. She never really expressed an interest to go in it, but look, apart from getting in and out of the seat, she's already had a double knee replacement, so it was a good test, and she passed the test. So, it's not impossible, but I don't know if you could live with – I'd need to see the standard seats, and I'd probably go with them. Well, you know what? I was thinking if you had plenty of bucks, I'd buy a GT3 Touring in shark blue for daily, and I'd buy the new RS as my really, you know, I want to kick your ass car for everyone else out there, you know, that wanted to take me on. And I think that would cost you. I reckon that the RS is going to be this is the GT3 is about 370 plus on road, so let's say $400,000. I think you'd need probably $550,000 for the new RS, so just shy of $1 million. You can have yourself. Well, that's what you do, Mandy. If you're a passionate enthusiast, you downsize, mate, and get into your two Porsches. Because at the end of the day, you're going to have a lot more fun in them than a big house, in my mind.
Me too.
You know? yes, it is livable, but I reckon you'd probably have to go the touring package. And because I just don't think you're going to use the wing and all those benefits enough. I think if you're really serious about taking your Porsche on track, wait for the RS to come out and grab the holy grail of track weapons, you know.
Yeah, perfectly wrapped up there, Croft. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Episode 1 for 2022 is an absolute wrap. Now, if you would like to send us an email, you can do it at podcast@carexpert.com.au. And if you are new to us, please give us a rating on whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on. Now, some cars we've got coming up in the garage next week, Moko. Hit us.
We've got some cool metal at the moment. So the new generation Subaru BRZ launch event is technically taking place next week, although at the moment, you know, when it comes to events, we never know if they're going to happen or not, do we? So let's just work on the assumption that it will happen and then we will drive it. We've got a bit of a forgotten competitor in the medium SUV market in the form of the Jeep Compass Trailhawk. We've got an Aston Martin DBX, which I think I might just quietly pull rank and pinch the keys to that. Especially now that Paul's away for the week, I can take the keys to the nice one. We've got the MG HSEV, plus EV, I should say, which is a plug-in hybrid. Slightly misleading branding there from MG, I would say, but it's a plug-in hybrid and it looks really good on paper, and I'm very curious to see how that goes. The Subaru Outback in sport spec level, one of the most popular SUVs on sale. Up in Sydney, we've got the brilliant Kurt Dupre driving the Volkswagen Arteon In liftback guise, and then we'll have the shooting brake wagon version shortly after that.
Yes.
Up in Brizzy, we've got a Genesis G70, a Toyota Supra revisit. Now, you might say Toyota Supra, who cares, old news, but Chris Atkinson's driving this one, so it's not going to be a typical review because a World Rally Championship driver, well, former World Rally Championship driver, will be putting it through its paces. We've also got a Hyundai Stelvio Highlander up there as well. So a really nice spread of vehicles, which will hopefully end up with cool reviews for you guys out there to read and watch.
Can you give us a bit of a preview of any comparisons you may have planned? So is it too early?
Yeah, so it's a bit light on for comparisons at the moment. We're sort of a victim of, I guess, having so much going on in other areas of the business. But I do have a few cool ones coming up. A little baby car one, Volkswagen Polo 85 TSI versus Kia Rio GT line. Sort of a first car special, as it were. Working on a couple of other electric car comparisons for the very near future as well. Obviously, that's a massive focus for us, so I'll be able to talk about those soon. But yeah, definitely endeavouring to sort of bump up those comparison numbers as the year goes on.
Good stuff. Mike Costello and Jack Quick, thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Mandy.